This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saturday Night Live is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. My guest, Lorne Michaels, created the show and is its executive producer. In October, he received the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor in a ceremony at the Kennedy Center. That ceremony will be shown as a 90-minute special this evening on public television. It will feature clips, tributes, and performances. Lorne Michaels has been with Saturday Night Live for all but five of its years, 1980 to 85. He produced many movies with performers who got their start on the show. Here's a sampling of the past 30 years of Saturday Night Live.
Hi, I'm Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night.
Good evening, I'm Chevy Chase, and you're not.
Now, a lot of people thought my last program was pretty crummy. Well, this one's truly crammed with clever revelations, rapport, and repartee.
We are two wild and crazy guys!
But no!
Jane, Wiggle, and Slut.
I am dark and you are light.
You are blind as a bat, and I have sight.
I am Hans.
I'm Don France.
And we want to pump you up.
Wayne, do you want to play Truth or Dare?
Truth or Dare? With me? No way.
Way.
No way.
Way?
Excellent.
Because I'm good enough. I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me.
Paul Newman's half Jewish, and Goldie Hawn's half too. Put them together, what a fine-looking Jew.
You're gonna be doing a lot of doobie rolling when you're living in a van down by the river.
You can't. You ain't got no alibi. You're ugly.
Good night and have a pleasant tomorrow.
Saturday Night Live is now the same age that Lorne Michaels was when he created the show, 30. I spoke with him about how the show began. Why was it important for you for Saturday Night Live to actually be live?
I think the most important reason at the time was that we wouldn't have to do a pilot. I had worked on enough pilots, three with Lily Tomlin and with a bunch of other ones where the way people talk themselves into things, or the way that overthinking works, is you say, well, you know, when we're on the air, we can make do different things, but now we just have to get on the air, and so you tend to want to please, and you tend to do things that have already been done because that's the way you're guided. And I thought if I could sort of get straight to the audience, if I could just do the show that I wanted to do and put it on the air, I thought, there'd be an audience for it. And being live, the danger which I didn't fully comprehend at the time, I'd done enough work on stage that I wasn't worried about that part. And also live audience was, you know, I knew would be exciting. But there was the idea that the whole country would see it at the same time, including the people at the network, who, while supportive, had bigger problems than what we were doing in late night. You know, they had a primetime schedule to worry about. So we were left alone, and also we were in New York, which there wasn't much production in. So we were kind of not on the radar, or whatever technology was dominant then.
The way the legend goes, John Belushi had said to you, I don't do TV, because he didn't like TV. And
that's
that
true.
You didn't get along, you know, at first. You know, there's this kind of like chemical difference between the two. So how come you hired him?
Well, what happened was I was fairly serious about things then, and I think I thought there was this little window of you know, that we could maybe climb through and try and get the show on television in a way that was pure. And so I wanted people who were completely committed. And I think John, who I think was completely committed, came into our meeting and made the point, which was a kind of backhanded compliment to me, that he didn't do television, but that, you know, sort of what I was doing was the exception that he was prepared to make. And I didn't want anybody who had any ambivalence. So I just said, well, if you don't do television, that's all right with me, because this is very much a television show. Also, people really looked down on television then. It was just thought it was too big a medium, too mass a medium, and I think people, it was looked down on. So, and I thought, having grown up watching television and loving television, I thought, well, I don't want anybody who's A, doing me a favor, and B, not completely committed to this. And I think John had really just misspoken. It was a sort of, it was just one of many, many meetings with lots of different people.
I want to read you something that Dan Aykroyd said in the book Live from New York, which is the book Tom Shales wrote, like a kind of oral history of Saturday Night Live. This has to do with the liveness of Saturday Night Live. He said,
right.
I once got mad and put a hole through a wall in Lorne's office. I punched a hole in it because I was so mad at the way he would give us last-minute changes before air. We would have to run down and give them to the cue card guys, and they would be going crazy and saying, are you kidding? You want us to get this on? So how do you deal with it when somebody in the cast puts a hole through your wall? I mean, when their temper just gets so out of control that it actually does physical damage.
It was there was a fair amount of volatility in that period of the show, but I think it was much more to do with all the changes that were swirling around us and that sort of intoxicating brew of fame and celebrity and money and power and all that, which was new to everyone there. It's not that way now.
People don't have tempers like that now?
No. I can't vouch for everyone, but I'd say that first period, or at least the period between around 1977, 78 was really the period that Danny's talking about. Because up to that point, it had a very strong all-for-one, one-for-all quality. And I think that changed when the opinion of the show changed.
And then everybody got really famous and...
Well, I mean, I think people... there was a little bit of a gold rush quality to it, and I think there was... and it still was, and still is, physically really hard to get that show on every week. I mean, we go from blank page to on the air in 6 days. So, and with a different host each week, which is a whole different set of writing problems. So writers and performers are working side by side. There's designers, there's musicians, there's filmmakers, there's a whole, and all of them tend to see and experience the show through the prism of their own experience. If their piece got on, they really liked the show last week. If their piece didn't get on, they didn't think people really liked that show. So it's a very intense process, and it can be bruising. It also is exhilarating, people wouldn't still be there doing it.
You know, from reading about the show, it sounds like one of the things that separates the first cast from subsequent casts is that the first cast, people were very close, and then people were sleeping with each other. So you have all these, like, professional competitions and jealousies mixed in with, like, romantic competitions and jealousies, and that's, whoa,
yeah,
what a brew.
I tend to think, oh, that's a little
overstated.
But it made for excellent reading, and
yes,
people are curious about it, and I think it's it's great. But that wasn't what was the determining thing in the show. I think everyone at the beginning of the show was unknown.
Right.
Everyone.
Right.
You know, and that meant the writers were unknown. People had tiny followings, I suppose, but on terms of a national level, no one was known. And then people became known and famous, and the impact of it was, more overwhelming. And I think that altered people's relationships, both with each other, their friendships, their, in some cases, marriages. I think it was, that nobody had ever done it before. I think it's much clearer now what sort of happens, and I think people know what it is.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorne Michaels, and he's the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is celebrating its 30th season this year. You've said that the value system that was around at the beginning was, as long as people showed up on time and did their job, it was nobody's business what they did in their bedroom or in their lives. And you said that value system turned out to be wrong.
Well, I think that we were what somebody older than me used to refer to as my pseudo-egalitarian value system. or the way I ran the show on that yeah. on that level. But I think that you just don't know. It starts with the core thing, which is the comedy. No one knows for sure what's going to work, what's not going to work. So no one has – there are people who are more experienced and therefore maybe listen to more. But at the end of the day, if the apprentice writer has a better joke than the senior writer, well, you have to go to the best joke. You have to go to the whatever, you know, the piece that involves building a ship, you know, that costs a lot of money didn't play, but the piece where the person sat on a chair worked perfectly. Well, you can't think of anything other than what's working. So that's people are up and down in that value system all the time. And I think that's that turbulence, which I like to think of as a sort of creative turbulence, is the defining thing of the show. You're always somebody who shouldn't emerges as the most interesting thing that week, because it's not ordained. It's just sort of we go in always long, and you don't, until that audience comes in, you really don't know what's going to work and what's not going to work. And I think that what was going on in the 70s nationally was, I think there was a strong fear of the government in the bedroom. I think there was a strong fear of too much, you know, this is right after Watergate. There was, and the Vietnam War. So I think there was a sort of new freedom, and we were testing the limits of it. And I think that what I believed then was that you didn't have responsibility. It wasn't your business. Therefore, it wasn't your responsibility. And I think that turned out to be wrong. We just didn't know enough.
At some point, did you feel that you were the executive producer, so it became your business to draw the line, even in people's personal lives, if you felt it was interfering in some way with your work on the air?
In the first 5 years, I wasn't executive producer. I was just producer. And right. That lofty title didn't exist. But mm-hmm. I think that we were all the same age. We were all friends. We all came from, you know, approximately the same kind of place. And so I wouldn't have... In the same way that when Chevy was leaving, he and I talked mostly as friends, much more than as producer, cast member. We, you know, whether or not it was the best thing for him to move on was much more about what would be best for him than it was, hey, come on, I think that it was fraternal. And I think as the years went by, I realized that more and more people looked to me in a paternal role, which was shocking to me because I was 31. And I think that when the same thing happened, for example, in the late 80s, when Chris Farley got into trouble, at the very first sign of it, you know, he was in rehab. Whereas I think when John Belushi was getting into trouble, it was hard to tell what was being on the cover of Newsweek and starring in Animal House and what people's limits were, what people could handle, or what was, you know, because it was all and most of I hope I'm not sounding defensive on this, but I think most of what happened to people that was destructive happened away from the show. In the case of John Belushi or the case of Chris Farley, it happened years after they left the show. And I think that the discipline of actually having to get that show on every week and of letting down your fellow cast or the writers, there was just always been too much of a standard there and too much of a work ethic for people to screw up there. I think, you know, you finish a show at 1 o'clock in the morning and an enormous amount of adrenaline's gone through your system, and you're not ready to go to sleep. And so people go to a party, and sometimes people want to, you know, obliterate the recent past or whatever. And I think, you know, it was all sort of uncharted territory then. I think it's very, very well-defined territory now. So I think people are just on the lookout for stuff that's destructive or self-destructive.
Well, you know, let me read you something that Bob Odenkirk, who had been a writer on Saturday Night Live, something that he said in the book Live from New York. He says, the greatest thing I ever saw Lorne do was the way he wound up treating Chris Farley. I think Lorne was determined not to have what happened to Belushi happen to Chris on his watch. And it seemed to me that Lorne very seriously put it to Chris, every time Chris messed up, he had to get cleaned up before he could come back on the show. Lorne really made Chris think about what he was doing, because the most important thing to Chris in the world was performing on that show. That was the goal of his life, and Lorne knew it. And Lorne took it away from him multiple times and forced him to go to rehab.
Yeah, I think that, well, it's so. But I think it was, we just knew more. You know, people would, you know, you'd see people in the 70s at 4 o'clock in the morning, and they'd, you know, look fine. Sometimes they wouldn't look fine, but I don't think anybody ever saw anybody in trouble and walked away from it. I think it was, you know, the next day we had a show to do, and people showed up, and that writers' meeting, which is on Monday, is the same now as it was then, and people had to show up for it, and they had to come prepared with an idea or two. So I think when people got away from the show and didn't have the structure and the discipline that the show demanded of them, I think people got into trouble.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking that it sounds like you really intervened in a positive way in Chris Farley's life when he was on the show.
Yeah, but and we did with John Belushi, too, multiple times. It's what I'm saying is that in the show was a caring environment. You know, it isn't like you want to see anybody get in trouble or you're aware that anybody's in trouble. I think that the sheer fatigue of in those days, 4 shows in a month, was, you know, people were bleary-eyed, people were exhausted, and people were still going on and doing the show. And I think that people who were used to that level of excitement, that level of whatever, when they suddenly left, people tried to get it in different ways, I think.
I have to say, it must be exhausting for you to have to oversee a weekly live show and also take some responsibility for helping people who are having trouble in the cast.
Yeah, I think I'm certainly better prepared to do it now than I was then. I think it was more, it's glib to say we were making it up as we went along, because I think we were more sure-footed than that. But I think there was so much we just didn't know. And then I think even we didn't even know that there was a much of an audience reaction to the show till this first summer, because we were always there. And New York City was moving along quite well without us. So it was only when we got out into the country that you realized people were actually watching the show. Because up to that point, you just sort of hear about it from your friends or your family. But we had no idea of the impact of it until I think Danny and John drove cross country in that first break we had in July of 76. And they were amazed that, you know, John came back and said, people really love that samurai thing I did. And at that point, we sort of had a rule about doing anything twice. And John was, you know, a prime proponent of that rule. So he was sort of taken aback when people went, when are you going to do it again, you know?
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lorne Michaels, the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is celebrating its 30th anniversary this year. Tonight, PBS will broadcast the tribute to Michaels held at the Kennedy Center last October when he was given the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor. Michaels insists he's not comfortable in front of the camera, but he's made some memorable appearances on Saturday Night Live. Here he is in 1976 trying to convince the Beatles to reunite and perform on the show.
Now here it is, as you can see, verifiably, it is a check made out to you, the Beatles, for $3,000. All you have to do is sing 3 Beatle tunes. She loves you, yeah, 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 that's $1,000 right there. You know the words, it'll be easy. Like I said, this is made out, this check here is made out to the Beatles. You divide it any way you want. You want to give Ringo less, that's up to you.
Let's get back to my interview with Lorne Michaels. Tom Sherrill says that although it's Saturday Night Live, you hate ad-libbing on the show. Why?
Yeah. Well, I like spontaneity. I just, you know, we're a written show. And because a lot of the people who appear on the show come from an improvisational background, I think the fantasy or the illusion was created somewhere in the 70s that it wasn't, the people were making it up as they went along. But that's, you can't set camera angles and cuts without a sort of real discipline, and that's a script, and it's a very strong writer's show, and people like Tina Fey, who's an absolutely brilliant writer, is also a performer. Now can she, as she's going, if something happens that she wasn't expecting, can she react to it and say something that hadn't been written? Absolutely. But by and large, what people are doing has been written, and the control room is sort of following that same script.
So many people on Saturday Night Live have gone on to not only be incredibly successful on the show, but to have incredible, acting careers, movie careers afterwards. Mm-hmm. A few people who were on Saturday Night Live who had really incredible careers afterwards were almost invisible while they were on Saturday Night Live. And I'm thinking specifically of, Robert Downey Jr. I just, don't even remember him when he was on Saturday Night Live.
He was not, that was a very bumpy season. It was him and Anthony Michael Hall.
Right,
And Joan Cusack was in that group, too. It was that was a cast that didn't gel. And the person responsible for it not gelling was me, because I made all the choices. But I think that Randy Quaid was in it as well. I think it was, there were elements of that 1985 cast that ended up being part of the, the following year I brought in Dana Carvey and Phil Hartman and Jan Hooks. And that group began to gel in a way that it hadn't in the 85 cast, 85, 86 cast.
Well, in that 85 cast, did you think, I lost it? I've lost my talent for picking
people.
Well,
no, it was a very tough time for me because, I did the first 5 years and then I left. And then when they were going to cancel the show, Brandon Tartikoff asked me if I'd come back and do it. And that was a sort of difficult decision for me. And when it looked like it actually would be canceled, although I wouldn't have cared if it had been canceled in any of the years that between then, or if they'd canceled it when I left in 1980, I think I would have been all right with that too then. But somehow it turned out it mattered to me. So when I came back in, I still had sort of, I'd forgotten so much how bruising it was, and I had very nice memories of what the first 5 years were like. And of course, what had been a very Saturday Night Dead appeared somewhere in the middle of the first season as a headline and never went away. And so suddenly to be beat up in 1985 by not having, it be the golden years, which as I was living were not called the golden years. It took a while to find a new way of doing the show. And I think when Brandon was trying to get me to come back, he said, in the 70s, you had to be the center of everything, of every sort of creative decision. But, you're older now and you have to learn how to delegate. And, and once you can delegate and, give authority to others and not be the center of things, then it would be much easier. And then at the end of the 85 season, he said, you can't delegate anything. You have to, and so I went back into it in a different way, and it worked out.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Lorne Michaels, and he's the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live, which is now celebrating its 30th year on the air. There's something I really want to ask you, and this is kind of under the category, but enough about you, what about me?
Uh-huh. Sure.
There was a sketch on Saturday Night Live that involved a public radio cooking show, and one of the hosts was named Terry. And some people, including members of my own family, have said to me, is that sketch have anything to do with you? And I'd say, no, it has absolutely nothing to do with me. But let me ask you, do you know the origins of where, like, what inspired that sketch?
When it was Anna and Molly, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
I think it was just the, I think they were playing with the dryness of and the, you know, cheerfulness of a certain kind of approach to what was, I don't know, I don't want to speak for them. I think they were just fooling around and that, and I think it was meant in a complimentary way.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you're going to get much more out of me on that. But I think that, as with all things, it's, you know, part of it's drawn from something they experienced or thought they could play.
Okay.
And then after that, it, you know, by the time it reached Alec Baldwin and Shweta Balls, it was a completely different kind of piece than where it started at the beginning. So I think,
just one more thing. Did you ever want to be a full-time performer yourself as opposed to, like, the behind-the-scenes guy? You've been on Saturday Night Live as yourself many times.
Yeah, no, and in the show I did in Canada, I was a performer. And I was – I think when I was college, I was in a bunch of plays. And occasionally I would look over at the person who was talking to me on stage, and I'd realize they actually were that character. Which was kind of, I thought, oh my God, they're completely lost in, they're not, you know, they are that person. I could never go that deeply, that deep. So I thought at best I could be, you know, okay. I didn't think I could be great at it. But, and I was more and more drawn, when I used to watch the show I did in Canada, I'd be in the editing room editing myself, and I'd see myself before the slate. And I'd see myself looking around, checking lighting and looking at camera angles and all that. And then the slate would happen, and then there'd be a big smile on my face that suddenly happened. And I thought, I'm not a natural at this. And I think that's fairly evident with today's interview. But I think...
You're not comfortable talking?
I like to perform, and I love being around performers, and I love... being around people are funny.
Lorne Michaels, congratulations.
So I have a good job is my point, yeah.
Yeah, congratulations on 30 years of Saturday Night Live. Incredible story. You've done incredible work. Thank you for talking with us about some of it.
Okay.
Lorne Michaels is the creator and executive producer of Saturday Night Live. Tonight, public television will broadcast the Kennedy Center tribute to him, at which he was given the Mark Twain Prize for American Humor.